Welcome to The Point. I'm Indy Todd. New Bedford is known as the Whaling City, and since the days of whaling, it's become a multi-ethnic, multicultural city. Many immigrants were drawn to the city for employment opportunities in the fishing industry, both shoreside and on the water. Others landed in the city unexpectedly and stayed on. Today, we discuss two New Bedford oral history projects. Later in the hour, we talk with the artist in residence at the New Bedford Whaling National Historic Park. She's capturing the voices of stories of New Bedford residents from all walks of life. But first, we discuss one of the current exhibits at the New Bedford Fishing Heritage Center. It's titled Casting a Wider Net, a Community Oral History Project. Joining us, Laura Orleans, Executive Director at the center. Welcome back, Laura. Good to see you.
Nice to see you, Mindy.
And Emma York, Project Manager for Casting a Wider Net. Hi, Emma.
Hello, thanks for having me.
So Casting a Wider Net brings the voices and stories of people of color who are part of the commercial fishing industry in New Bedford. What was the genesis for the project?
The Fishing Heritage Center has long had oral history at its foundation because we feel that stories are a really powerful way of sharing lived experience. In the 20 years ago, when we began our Working Waterfront Festival, we even began collecting stories. And I will say that initially the stories were those of the owners of the businesses and the captains of the boats, and predominantly of white men, many of whom have come from other places, so Norway and Portugal and the Canadian Maritimes. But as we progressed in our desire to capture the stories of the fishing community, we wanted really to bring in the voices of many, many people. This industry provides employment for about 7,000 people. And some of them have come very recently. Some of them are women. They work in many different jobs. And so this project has been sort of an outgrowth of that journey to widen the net. This has some special qualities to it that I think Emma can speak to, which really had to do with building capacity among community members to do the interviews.
Yeah, go ahead, Emma, tell us about that.
Sure. So I think what is unique about this project and the reason that it's called a community oral history project as opposed to an oral history project generally is that we worked with 9 community members, some of whom had never heard of oral history or done an oral history before, but had lived experience as members of the Cape Verdean, Vietnamese, and Central American community here in Greater New Bedford or Providence, and wanted to be part of helping to tell the story of people from their own ethnic communities. And so we engaged in multiple trainings, both with Laura, who spoke to a little bit of the context and history of New Bedford's commercial fishing industry, Dr. Amina Pilgrim, who shared a little bit about oral history methodology and specifically working with the Cape Verdean community, and Marta V. Martinez, who is the founder and director of Rhode Island Latino Arts and a specific oral history project capturing the voices of Latinos living in Rhode Island, to think about how to conduct oral history in a way that was sensitive to the interviewer's positionality and identities, to documentation status, and to language. Mm-hmm. So this oral history project was quite ambitious in the sense that interviews were conducted in multiple languages, and the exhibit that was born out of this project is also accessible to the public in multiple languages, including Cape Verdean Criollo, Spanish, English, and soon to be Vietnamese.
Yeah. It is so, one of the cool things I think about this project is that you trained these individuals from the community to interview, record their peers, right? And that's the important part here is their peers. I imagine there's a much more of a comfort level and able to really get the story, if you will, right? So how did you find the people interested in collecting the stories from their community to do this training?
Yeah, so we put a call out a little over a year ago, and we had a survey that people could take to tell us a little bit more about who they are and why they're interested in this work and what sorts of experiences, even if they're not direct oral history experiences, they might be able to bring to bear. And we wanted to keep in mind Three criteria really in choosing individuals. So if someone had a direct connection to the commercial fishing industry, that was important lived experience that we wanted to highlight. If someone had multiple languages that they're able to speak fluently, that was something we knew would be really important in order to reach folks whose stories might not otherwise get to be shared, who are native Spanish speakers, Criollo speakers, and even Mayan Quiche speakers. So an indigenous language of Guatemala. Mm. And then we had wonderful partners in the community who helped us put that call for community ethnographers out into the world. I'm very deeply entrenched in this community, having lived here my entire life and worked in education and community outreach. And so I was able to tap into some of those networks. And we were really lucky to source 9 people who brought such a breadth of experience and knowledge and expertise. I think Laura's maybe told you, but we had community ethnographers ranging in age from just 13 years old all the way up until their late 70s. We had women and men and people from all sorts of different ethnic communities, and it became a really powerful intergenerational and intercultural family of community ethnographers. At each of our trainings, we tried to have food that represented the cultures that we were focusing on in the project. So sometimes that food was purchased from a local restaurant, and other times it was cooked by some of our community ethnographers, some family recipes or recipes from the communities that they had grown up in.
That's so cool. Let's jump in and hear from one of the people interviewed for the project. Is there any background about Anthony, who's of Vietnamese descent, that you'd like to give us before we hear from him? And who is interviewing Anthony?
Anthony comes from the Vietnamese community. While he was born and raised in the United States, his father and many of the other men in the Vietnamese community came from a very small island off the east coast of Vietnam. And a lot of them, when they came after the war, were refugees, ended up in New Bedford. Anthony's father was one of those people. And Anthony himself thought about pursuing that, but ended up making a different choice, going to college and becoming an accountant. So not a job that you necessarily even think is something in the fishing industry, but accounting is, you know, there are many pieces to the puzzle.
There's a good handful of Vietnamese people in the New Bedford that scallop. I can say like 85-95% of the Vietnamese dads in this community scallop. I was a senior in high school, and my dad at the time was a scalloper, and so he would ask me to unload the ship when it returned, and I would just unload bags of scallops. Like, each bag was 50 pounds, and they would send me in they call it the hell hole, and that's where all the scallop bags are stored, and you just have to shovel a bunch of ice and scallop bags into this bucket, and then they kind of just reel it up. So it was a lot of labor. And I was actually thinking about doing scalloping because the money paid really well. Then I started thinking about college, and then I kind of shifted my career choice. And I ended up here at Norpel as a cost accountant. We buy and sell processed seafood and meat for pet food.
Up next, we have Colleen Pina-Garin. What can you tell us about her and the person who interviewed her?
So Colleen was actually one of our community ethnographers. So she sat on both sides of this project, both as someone who interviewed 2 people and as someone who was interviewed herself about her father's experience as a stevedore on the waterfront.
My dad was a man that they don't make anymore. He had 8 children that he had to support. So he had many jobs, one being a stevedore on the waterfront. When he was stevedoring, I never knew where he went because he left so early in the morning. Usually the ships came in very, very early. It was still dark. And he'd come home and we'd have breakfast and he'd get ready to go to his second job and we'd go to school. Each club had their own set of men that would come. Because the shape-up notice would be put on all of the clubs, the band club, the United Social Club, or the Old Holland Street Club. and the vets. Whenever there was a shape up, he would go down to the docks, and shape ups are, before they had telephones, before they had the internet and all that, they would post a sign in the bars, the Cape Verdean bars, on the bulletin boards, and it would say shape up tomorrow, 5 a.m. or 4 a.m. or whatever, and people would show up, the men would show up at the docks, because they really didn't hire women back then, but the men would show up at the docks, and the stevedores would be on the ship operating the cranes and the backhoes and everything to move cargo off of the ships that were coming in onto the dock so that the longshoremen could then load them where they needed to go, unload them or load them. And before the union, the stevedores were in charge of handing out those jobs to the men that came. I learned a little bit about what a longshoreman was and what the term comes from. And it was when boats came in, they would walk along the shore and ask if anybody wanted work. And that's how the term longshoreman came up. I think they brought more cargo in before the dikes came in. And I think that there were probably a lot more men that got hired. So I'd say probably 30 or 40, as opposed to now where, you know, the hurricane decks are here and they can't accept the large cargo ships that they used to be able to accept. I don't think that people who worked in the industry in any capacity during that time, I think they really wanted their kids to work in the industry. That wasn't someplace that they wanted us really to be. The docks were a dangerous place, too. My dad was very, very protective. He had 6 girls and 2 boys. He was very protective of his girls. There was no way he was taking us to the waterfront. There was no way. My father used to always say, make sure you study, a book is less to carry than a pick and shovel, because he didn't want us to have to work as hard as he did. But as we got our degrees and we went on to office jobs, he called them, he was quite proud of that because we got vacation days and we got sick days. And those were things that he didn't get. Even with the union, I don't ever remember my father taking a sick day. At the time that my father was a stevedore, we were living in the Bay Village, which to us was the best place on the planet to grow up. All we had to do was go outside and there were friends all over the place. And we had our cousins and everybody that lived around us. And the mailman lived in one. The policeman lived a block up. Anybody that was Cape Verdean and grew up in that neighborhood knew everybody that worked at the docks. All of the women that worked in the fish houses. All of the lumpers that would bring us fish. My uncle used to always come with like a box of fish, and I could hear my mother yelling at him that it better be scaled because she wasn't scaling any fish. But it was hard work, and a lot of people from our community had no choice but to do this work. I'm not so sure that if my father had not been a stevedore operating the equipment instead of unloading all of those ships, that he would have lasted that long in that job, because he did that all day long as his job, you know. But he did what he had to do. He did what he had to do. I think that whole first generation of Cape Verdeans, that was an incredible group of people. And they wanted more for their kids.
Another thing we hear in these stories is the respect people had for their parents, their work ethic, and as Colleen says, their desire for their children to have more than they did. And that's a theme I imagine you got quite a bit. Yeah. Up next, we have Deem. This is a pseudonym for, he was born in El Salvador, right? So let's hear from him and we'll talk more about his story.
I was born in El Salvador, San Salvador to be specific, and at the age of 5, I was brought to the United States, specifically coming to the port city of New Bedford. We came and lived on Purchase Street for, I want to say, a year or two, and it was a small apartment on the third floor, and we had like 8 to 11 people living in that apartment, and it was only 2 bedrooms. But it was all family, so at the time, that's all I knew, and I thought that was normal for everybody. I grew up predominantly in a Hispanic household. going to church, a lot of Hispanic traditions. But in school, there was very little of me represented. And typically, during those times, you tended to get bullied because you were different from everybody else. Both my parents, my aunts, all worked in the seafood processing industry. Companies would hire them at low wages to process the seafood that came off the boats those days. Even if you have a green card or permanent residency, it's always something that hinders in my head. That's why we're waiting and hoping for citizenship in the future. It's not something that, like I mentioned before, someone that wants to actually go and be a truck driver for a fishing industry or being on the seafood processing floor. So that way you're persistent to do what's best either for you or for your family. And then it's humbling because you're able to do that every day and still be happy with life. A lot of the times, the people that you see working in these facilities, they're providing for a family here in the U.S. In terms of apartment, education, food. But they also, a number of times, have to support family back home at their original country. So the wages that they get aren't very much, just considering the rent and the cost of food. And they always have to set aside money to send back home to their parents or their grandmothers or whoever it may be.
Part of the interview with Deem that we didn't include was him talking about his enrollment at Bristol Community College and then Mass Maritime. Explain how his lack of citizenship impacted his major at MMA.
Well, I'll start by saying that access to financial aid, so things like FAFSA, is not something that undocumented students can access. Mm-hmm. So if you think about the huge barrier that sets up, that's part of the reason that he was working three jobs the entire time that he was getting his education, and part of the reason that he decided to follow in his father's footsteps and participate in the commercial fishing industry as a truck driver. The other piece that is important to note for his story in particular is that his initial major at Mass Maritime would have had him going out on commercial fishing vessels beyond the limits that would allow him to come back to shore without citizenship documents. Mm-hmm. And so he ended up switching his major and is really, really happy with where he's ended up. He draws some interesting parallels between his work now and his work in the fishing industry and the transferable skills that he sees, as well as the ways that there is inequality both in fish processing, but also in food packaging, which is the industry that he now works in. Mm.
Up next, we have Deb Soares. Any background you'd like to share about Deb before we hear her interview?
So Deb was one of two women who Colleen interviewed. We were really excited about Colleen's involvement in the project in terms of finding and having the long-term relationships that allowed for the stories that she revealed in her interviews. So Deborah's mother was Mary G. Soares, and she worked in the fish processing plants back, I think, in the 60s and 70s, at a time when the unions were coming into place and were really important in terms of working conditions. Those unions no longer exist, so that whole system has changed. But I think that we at the Fishing Heritage Center have long been interested in the story of unions and the story of the loss of unions on the waterfront, and have struggled to get the stories from people outside of the Portuguese community who've worked in the fish plants. And so being able to speak to, there were many, many Cape Verdeans who took on that employment because to some extent, there was also racism that played into that. They were allowed into certain aspects of the fishing community or other jobs and not others. And seafood processing is not glamorous work. It's very hard work. A lot of women ended up with all kinds of health problems as a result. And Deb speaks to that as well.
And I believe Deb and Laverne both speak to the idea that at the time there weren't many job opportunities available to Black women and Cape Verdean women in particular. So there was that double oppression of being both a woman and a person of color, which led to limited employment opportunities.
I grew up in a Bay Village, single mom, with a lot of other family members that lived in a village. Actually, some of them were there ever since the Bay Village was built in the early 1940s. And it was a community of people, family members as well as others, that were very village-like. They helped bring up everybody that was there. So no matter who it was, you respected your elders. It taught me a lot to respect elders. It taught me a lot about family, what it means to have not just your immediate family, but extended family. Later on in life, as I was older and moved back to New Bedford, they would say, oh, you know, the villages, the Bay Village was, it's a project. It was for poor folks. I never felt that. My mother was a single parent, and she had to survive. So the only thing that was really going on that women could work at was basically the fish houses. Also, my other family members, my aunts, my mother's sisters, my mother's aunts, they all worked in the fish house as well. It was interesting growing up at that time because all I remember was my mother would leave the house, say, I want to say it was around 6:30 to be there for 7 o'clock in the morning, and sometimes they had to be there for 6 o'clock in the morning. So my mother would prepare my breakfast before I go to school. She'd prepare my breakfast. I'd get myself ready and everything. And then she would go off to work. She would be off to work. She'd be gone all day. She worked in the fish house for about 30-something years. She retired at the age of 65. However, while she was there, she used to do everything from cutting. Well, I think they called it scaling the fish, weighing the fish, you name it. Worked in ice-cold temperatures, a lot of ice. But when I used to see her, she used to be getting the fish from these big containers and putting them on like a belt, like a conveyor belt. And it would go to the next person. Next person would scale it. The next person would cut. So it was a... like an assembly line. She did have arthritis at the time, and of course in her elder years it got worse. It was very hard work, very, very hard work for the women. Oh my God, I've never heard her complain. My aunts too, same thing. I've never heard them complain. When they came out from the fish house, they smelled like the fish. It was not pleasant. However, they wore it with like... nothing. You know, if they had to make a stop after work, stop in the store, they'd go with their fish clothes. Scales all over them.
One of the themes that really stands out in these conversations is how very difficult fishing industry jobs are. They're physically taxing, yet as we heard Deb say, people don't complain.
Yes, and there's a lot of pride in a positive way, though it doesn't get a lot of airtime, right? Mm-hmm. You know, I think people in working class jobs don't get the chance to be celebrated or to really talk about what they do. There is pride, there is resiliency, there is hard work, absolutely. And I think there is, there's always a desire for parents to create a situation that is easier for their children. I think all parents want their kids not to struggle in the way that they may have.
And I will add to that by saying that it was really interesting to hear how people with different language backgrounds, different ethnicities, ended up mentoring each other or creating informal apprenticeships with other people at their workplace. And so we have people who came to the U.S. as K'iche' speakers and then learned Spanish. And instead of learning English, they actually ended up learning Cape Verdean Creole because it was a Cape Verdean Creole speaking person who took them under their wing when they joined and taught them all of the skills that they needed to succeed at their job. And so it's really interesting to think about the idea of cultural brokers and people who have supported newer immigrant communities in acclimating and thriving in their workplace.
We're talking with Laura Arlenes and Emma York about a new exhibit at the New Bedford Fishing Heritage Center titled Casting a Wider Net, a Community Oral History Project. And we'll have more after a quick break. You're listening to The Point. We're discussing a new exhibit at the New Bedford Fishing Heritage Center titled Casting a Wider Net, a Community Oral History Project. With us is Laura Arlenes, Executive Director at the Center, and Emma York, Project Manager for Casting a Wider Net. The last piece we have is from Kevin Rose. Could one of you give us a little more background on Kevin and his role with the Longshoremen?
Sure. So Kevin Rose, also a Cape Verdean American, works as a longshoreman. The Longshoremen's Union in this area is unique in that it was founded by Portuguese and Cape Verdean people. And it is the only union that is still active on the waterfront in New Bedford. Longshoremen, if you don't know, are people that offload cargo. Sometimes the cargo is palletized frozen blocks of fish. Other times it is cars or, many other things. Nowadays, as New Bedford moves into the wind industry, it is often the supplies and parts that are needed for building wind turbines. And so Kevin tells the story of kind of watching that industry come into town as the president of the union and hearing that there was a lot of promise of local people being hired and looking at the workforce and seeing virtually no people of color and going basically waging a strike and going to bat for his community to make sure that they made good on their promises to hire local folks. And he's been successful and they're growing that workforce. It involves a lot of training to make sure that people have the safety protocols and the ability to, you know, handle the heavy equipment and so on. But he's very dedicated to the idea that these jobs need to be serving our local community, in particular people of color and women. He's trying to get more women into that job workforce. And he's very excited and sees a very bright future.
Before the wind turbines came here in last June, we hadn't had work for 3 years. And even before that, we'd only have Moroccan fruit would probably only come in one ship, 24, 26 hours every other week for 4 months and then nothing. So this is huge for us, this wind turbine project. We load and unload vessels. For example, we scrap metal, might be some salt, might be lumber, fish, or whatever it may be. We have the ILA members are the crane operators, right? They're the sign men. They're the forklift operators in the hold, what we call inside the ship. And we have forklift operators that work on the dock that take it into the warehouse. I would get a call from a company that's bringing in fruit, whatever they're bringing in, right? Mm-hmm. We're going to have three-man gangs, they call them. 15-man gangs, right? They'll all be 15-man gangs. So they call me, Kevin, I'm on the ship coming in, I need three gangs. So that's 10, 20, 30, that's 45 guys. They call, then I would do a shape-up. We have a telephone number that you would call. It's like an answering machine. I would put on it, there's a shape-up tomorrow morning, New Bedford State Pier, 7 o'clock shape. For 7:30 stop. Now we don't do shape-ups. The companies are asking for the same people. The big companies, they don't want that. They want the same people all the time. They trained you, cost the money, you know. I'm just the dispatcher, dispatching the labor. I pick the foremans, and then we go to the company, and they approve or they disapprove. Most of the time, they approve. When the wind turbines came here, I walked my dog down there, and I looked through the fence, and I was yelling at the people, how come there's no local people? Six people out of this whole community that's been doing longshoremen down here since 1936, who happen to be 90% people of color. Just happen to be. So when you say you have this program to help minorities, but you ain't doing it. You're just not. My job is the president of unions to put people to work. That's my job. That's what I got elected for, right? So when I go down there and I don't see people of color, I don't see anybody from my community. Finally, we negotiate. I have right now 26 people working down there right now, which they want to start off with six. I wanted more. I'm still trying to get more to this day. So by the next project, we'll have, instead of 26 people, we're looking at 60 people working. That's a lot for my community working.
There are so many other voices and stories we don't have time to hear today. If you had to pick one story that really stands out to you from the collection, what would it be?
Well,
I think I know what my story would be. I would recommend that you come down to the center and listen to Miguel's story. He works at Radar's Trawl and Gear Manufacturing in New Bedford, which creates rigging and netting for commercial fishing vessels. And he came to work there from Cuba to Nova Scotia and now to New Bedford, Massachusetts in the United States. And so he speaks both about his experience attending a formal fishing school in Cuba under Cuban dictatorship and jumping ship to Nova Scotia, where he had to live for 5 years without seeing his wife or child. And he speaks really poignantly about the moment that he reunited with them. Mm-hmm. It still sits with me. He said it was a really, really cold day, but I felt warm. Warm because he was able to be with his loved ones for the first time in 5 years. And he also speaks really beautifully about what it means to work in a family business. So many of the businesses where our narrators work are family owned, but there's also a sense of chosen family. So all of the different workers who feel that they are part of the family in certain ways because they have built and grown the organization or the business alongside the business owners.
Laura?
Boy, it's hard to choose. I had Miguel in mind as well, but also I would say Pentelion Tonotono, who is Maya Quiche. So came from the highlands of Guatemala, works at Atlantic Shellfish as a welder. And, you know, just this, the story of his journey, the story of why he had to leave, why he left, what it was like to get here, like the whole sort of very, very difficult road that a lot of migrants take to get here. And then the story of kind of how he's mastered skills and his dreams and aspirations. He talks about one day having his own welding shop, maybe here and maybe in Guatemala.
The exhibit is Casting a Wider Net, a community oral history project. It's open at the New Bedford Fishing Heritage Center. Laura, how long is it going to be up?
It'll be up through June 1st.
So we've got plenty of time to get down and see it. All right. And we're going to post a link with more information at our website, capeandislands.org. Laura Orleans is executive director and Emma York project manager. Thanks so much for being with us and for the work of bringing these amazing stories to the greater community. We really appreciate that.
Thank you so much for having us.
Thank you for having us.
Coming up after a break, we hear from the artist in residence at the New Bedford Whaling National Historic Park. Her project is called New Bedford in the Palm of Your Hand. Stay with us.